Welcome to the Deadcast.
Saturday, April 12th, 1980. 14-year-old Sheila Sharp walks from the cabin of her friends and neighbors, the Siebel family, to the cabin she shares with her own family, number 28. It has been a typical quiet weekend as she steps into the run-down cabin, freezing as she beholds the sight before her. Her mother, Sue, lies on the floor, bound. It is obvious from the amount of blood present that she is dead. Nearby, her older brother, John, also lies dead. He is bound in a similar fashion. And near his body, John's friend, Greg. He too is dead. Her body awash in horror and terror, Sheila rushes back to the Siebold house. He does his best to calm the young girl. He quickly ascertains that something horribly tragic has taken place and heads over to cabin 28 to see for himself. His concern for his neighbors is overshadowed by the fact that Sheila has told him there are other children in the house. James knows that he can't let the younger kids see what has happened to their mother. After sticking his head inside the back door for a moment, he heads around to the bedroom window and convinces Nick and Greg Sharp to join him, as well as their friend, Justin Smart. Of the other child he had been expecting to find, Sheila's younger sister, Tina, there is no sign. It won't be long before the campground where they all live, known as Keddy Cabins, is overrun by Plumas County Sheriff's officers, attempting to ascertain not only what has taken place, but who could possibly have committed such a gruesome, heinous act. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me once again. As you heard in that little trailer, we're going to be looking at the Keddy Cabin murders that took place in April of 1980. But before we get into the case at hand, I'd like to remind everyone that if they enjoy this show, the best way to support it is to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else it is that you find your podcasts. I can also be found on Twitter and Instagram at Author Totten. If you'd like to help support the production of this show, there's two ways to do that. You can find me on Patreon at Ian Totten or on Venmo and PayPal at Ian Totten. That would be for a one-time donation. Again, any support that can be given is greatly appreciated, as making this show is very, very time-consuming. Not only do I have to research the case for this week, but I'm also writing and recording the background music that you hear for every episode, while writing, holding down a full-time job, and helping to raise a family. All right, the plugs are out of the way. Grab yourself something to drink. I have my coffee and cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. The Keddy murders are a rather infamous case, and it's one of the cases that I find the most fascinating. In fact, when my family and I were preparing to move back from Northern California to our current location, we contemplated stopping in Keddie and seeing the crime scene, only to find out that the cabins had all been torn down and that the area was now blocked from people coming and visiting, you know, ghoulish curiosity seekers. So we were not able to. But the area we were living in California has two ties to this case that I will get into when we reach those points in the case. This is a fairly complex, unsolved murder. There has been a lot of media coverage of the murders throughout the years. Within the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot more coverage as new breakthroughs in forensic science and new people joining the Plumas County Sheriff's Office have taken another look at the case. But we're going to start at the beginning with what the police found. When they arrived on the scene, the Plumas County Sheriff's Department found a fairly vicious scene. Glenna Sue Sharp was found lying on her side near the living room sofa. She was wearing a shirt but was nude from the waist down. She had been gagged with a blue bandana and her own underwear, which had been secured in place with tape. Sue had been stabbed in the chest and her throat was cut. There was a mark on the side of her head from a Daisy Model 880 BB gun, which the fact that there was a mark left from the BB gun should give you some idea as to the viciousness of the attack. You really would have to slam someone in the side of the head with a BB gun in order to leave a visible impression there. Her 15-year-old son, John, had his throat cut. There were also defensive wounds visible on the boy, and his friend Dana Wingate had multiple head injuries and had also been manually strangled. They also discovered that all three victims had blunt force trauma wounds to their head, and they quickly ascertained what had caused this. They found a bloody hammer on scene, as well as two knives, one of which was a steak knife that had been bent in half from the force of the blows that it had inflicted. Blood splatter evidence, which is something that crime scene investigators use to determine where and from what angle an attack took place, showed them that all three of the murders had taken place in the living room. There was a lot going on with this crime scene. Unfortunately, though, it really was not contained by the Plumas County Sheriff's Office. The first man on the scene was Deputy Hank Clement, and he went inside and confirmed that everybody inside was deceased. He was soon joined by Sergeant Jerry Shaver, who spent his time questioning people outside. At some point, the two men went into the house and did a quick walkthrough before Sheriff Sylvester Doug Thomas and Assistant Sheriff Ken Shanks came. They were soon joined by another man named Don Stroy, and from what I can ascertain, the five of them continuously trampled through the house before they ever thought to call and have a crime scene photographer come. They did do a house-by-house welfare check to see if anyone else had been assaulted during the previous evening. They also interviewed potential witnesses, a few of whom stated that their animals had been acting oddly the previous evening. One individual also stated that they saw the back door light on outside of Cabin 28 around 4 a.m. And here's where things get pretty odd. The police did not notice that Tina Sharp was missing until hours after they arrived at the scene. At which point they contacted the FBI, who came in to help investigate Tina's disappearance. Sadly, though, they were only involved for about 2 weeks before turning the case back over to the Plymouth County Sheriff's Department. As for the house itself, the bodies had been restrained using medical tape as well as extension cords and cords that had been cut from appliances within the house. There were also large pools of blood with drag marks coming out of them, which told the sheriff's department that the killers had taken their time in the attack. It wasn't something where they had come in and been frenzied about it. They had taken their time with the act that they were committing, to the point that Sheila and one of the boys had blood on their feet, which told the investigators that both of them had been marched through the pools of blood at some point during the assault. They questioned Sheila about the medical tape that had been used to bound the victims, and she stated that it was not tape that had been inside the house, which meant that the killers had brought it with them. So they began to suspect that this had been a premeditated murder. Something of interest that came up once the autopsy had been completed was that Dana Wingate had been bashed in the head with a hammer different than the one that had been found on the scene. At the time, they had no idea what this hammer was, what it looked like. They just knew that there was another murder weapon that wasn't accounted for. Some other evidence that was found on the scene were drops of blood on Tina's bed, a bloody footprint in the yard, as well as knife marks throughout the home, as though somebody had walked through the house stabbing the walls. The sheriff's department assumed almost from the start that two men had been involved in the murders, and as they talked to the people living up at Kenny Cabins, they quickly learned that a gray van had been seen sitting in front of the Sharp household around 9 o'clock, while others stated that they had seen a Datsun sitting in front of the house in that same time frame, although the Datsun appeared to have been sitting on a flat tire. Investigators believed that the people who perpetrated the murder had worn gloves because, other than the one bloody fingerprint, there were no fingerprints or any other discernible DNA left in the house. So the things that we always see them doing in television shows, like finding fiber transfers, hair, skin cells, that kind of stuff, none of that was collected at the scene until much later. In the 80s, when the sheriff's department decided to see if they could find any DNA evidence on the things they had already collected. So the police really didn't have a lot to go on. Supposedly, the Plumas County Sheriff's Office spent around 4,000 hours investigating this case. And the case had some pretty drastic effects on Keddie, which anyone who doesn't know Northern Californian towns, a lot of them are extremely small. I'm talking, you know, from a few hundred people to a few thousand. Everyone knows everyone in town. Some people leave their doors unlocked. They're very rural, with a lot of forests and open fields, and there's just absolutely nothing. The place that my family and I lived in California was a small town called Flournoy. There were estimated 102 people in town, and in order to get to a grocery store, it was at least a 20-plus minute drive into the next town over, which was a town called Corning. The area that the Keddy murders took place in was very similar. It was almost exactly across the state in the Sierra Nevadas. There was really nothing in Keddy, save for I believe there was a general store and a bar. There was a couple of towns nearby, but these are very sparsely populated, closed societies. The type of place where if somebody who is unknown comes into town, very soon everybody knows about them. And everybody in Keddy began looking at their neighbors as a possible suspect. I've read a couple reports that gun sales had gone up in the area, as well as that people started locking their doors and warning their children to be careful of the people that they associated with, because the parents just didn't know who it was that had committed these crimes. Rumors started spreading throughout town pretty quickly that there might have been, you know, some sort of religious cult involved in the murders, but the most prevalent was that there were drugs involved in these murders. A lot of people who already didn't trust Sue Sharp, which I'm going to get to in a moment, they suspected maybe she had possibly been selling drugs and that the deaths were a result of this. Others, Kate, were of the belief that Dana Wingate had been the intended target, as there was a rumor going around town that he had stolen a large quantity of LSD from a local drug dealer, and as a result, this drug dealer had sought revenge against him and murdered this family as a result of it. The Plumas County Sheriff Doug Thomas discounted these rumors, stating that they found no evidence of drugs or drug paraphernalia in the cabin. The sheriff's department did an extensive background search on Sue Sharp and her family to help eliminate the idea that possible drugs were involved. Glenna Susan Sue Sharp was born March 29, 1945 in Springfield, Massachusetts. She married a man who was in the military named James Sharp, and together they had five children. By all accounts, James was a very abusive man, and it was because of this that Sue and her children left Connecticut and moved to Northern California, where Sue's brother and his wife lived. They initially stayed in a small trailer in Quincy, California, which is a town right next to Keddy, before moving into the cabins in Keddy. And Keddy had been a resort town that had seen a small boom in tourism, but that had dried up long before the family moved into the cabins. And when they moved into the cabins, they were in pretty bad shape. But Sue, who didn't have a job, was receiving $200 for a month from her ex-husband for the children, was on welfare, and was also enrolled in some form of government program wherein they gave her money in order that she could attend college classes at the local community college. She was willing to take whatever it was that she could in order to ensure her family had a roof over their heads. And it seemed to be a good fit. As I stated, these small communities in Northern California where everyone knows everyone, the kids all play together, the parents, if they're not friends. They're at least on friendly terms with each other. So to her mind, it seemed like the best place to possibly raise her kids while attempting to better herself. Even still, Keddie and Quincy are two small communities. There were a lot of rumors going around about Sue. It was noted that she had a lot of different boyfriends, and a number of people in the area speculated that they weren't really boyfriends, they were clients, and that Sue, in fact, was prostituting herself in order to pay the bills. There is no evidence to support this idea, nor is there any evidence to support the idea that she was, in fact, selling drugs. It boils down to that she was a mother of five kids living in a lower income area. She was on welfare, and people in these areas really don't have anything else to do other than talk. As stated, she had five kids, the oldest being John, who was born November 16th, 1965. From everything that I have read, John was a bit of a troublemaker who had a bit of a mouth on him. He just seems like your atypical, you know, punk kid. You know, getting into a lot of stuff that he probably shouldn't be, maybe smoking some pot, but nothing too serious. After that, she had had Sheila, and then another daughter named Tina, who was born July 22nd, 1968. Lastly, there were two younger sons, Rick, who was 10 at the time of the murders, and Greg. From everything I could read on the subject, and even talking to the surviving daughter, the Sharp family, they weren't the most outgoing. They were cordial to their neighbors. The kids were all friends with children that lived in the neighborhood. Sue mainly kept to herself, but she was at least on speaking terms with her neighbors and everybody else that lived in the town. She was known on occasion to go down to the one bar that they had, but beyond that, she spent most of her time attending school. So the police really didn't have much to go on. As best as they could, they reconstructed the events of April 11th in order to see if anything may have led to the murders. That day, April 11th, at around 1:30 that in the afternoon, Sue and Sheila had driven from the cabin in Keddie to Quincy, which is about 5 miles away, to pick up John and his friend Dana from Ganser Park. And a few hours later, roughly 3:30, both boys had hitchhiked back to Quincy, where it's thought that they had been going to hang out with friends. And around that time, they had been seen in the downtown area, and a local woman named Donna Williams said she had picked them up in front of a tire store and given them a ride down the road to another friend's house. They were seen later that day attending a party at Oakland Camp, which is also in Quincy. Some point that evening, they had hitchhiked back to Keddie. I've read different accounts of it, but most seem to agree that it was fairly late at night, especially for two 15-year-olds to be out. As for Sue, she had been planning on just having a quiet evening in the house while her oldest daughter, Sheila, went over to the Siebold family's home to spend the night. And around 8 o'clock, Sheila had left cabin 28 and gone to the Siebold's home, at which point her sister, who had been watching television with the Siebold family, returned to the cabin. So that leaves the night in question. What exactly had happened? Well, initially, they had very few suspects, and they did not have any witnesses. But this changed when Rick and Greg's friend, Justin Smart, who is also known as Justin Estes, was questioned by his mother and claimed to have possibly dreamed about seeing two men inside the living room arguing with Sue. She brought this to the attention of the sheriff's department, and what I'm telling you now is what Justin said through various statements as well as under hypnosis. His story has changed somewhat under the years, so I'm going to try and go right down the middle and get the most concise version of the story. As I stated, he initially said that he had had a dream about it. Later, this changed to that he had heard some noise from the living room while he was sitting in Greg and Rick's bedroom and gotten up to go investigate what was going on. He had seen two men in the living room, one of them with a mustache, the other with kind of long hair, both of them wearing glasses, and they were arguing with Sheila. Not long after this, John and his friend Dana arrived home, and the argument escalated. And eventually, Tina came into the house, and one of the men had picked her up and physically removed her from the scene. He has said in some places that he actually saw the murders taking place, in others that he went back to bed at this point. There is even a few conspiracy theorists out there that believe that Justin actually participated in the murders, which I believe his age was around 12 at the time. I find that highly unlikely. In any event, the sheriff's department were able to have a drawing done of the two suspects that they were looking for. And these, as well as crime scene photos and other things, I will be sharing on the Instagram account, which is, again, Author Totten. But around the time all of this was going on, the police did, in fact, come up with two suspects. And I will be getting to them in just one moment. But first, this message. Authors and small businesses, are you looking for an inexpensive, reliable way to promote your business? Advertising on a podcast such as this one can help to greatly expand your business, as I learned firsthand when I ran ads on Arcadian Vanguard Podcasting Network's show, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I ran 3 or 4 different spots on the show over the course of about a year and saw immediate results with increased sales and readership. And I continue to see results from those ads to this day. It's just like running an ad on a radio program. And unlike an online ad that you would take out on Amazon or Twitter, your ad will stay up in perpetuity for the life of the podcast and could potentially reach hundreds, if not thousands, of listeners on a weekly basis on a wide range of platforms from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbeam, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, even Amazon Music. Some podcasts will charge you for anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand dollars for a quick 30 to 60 second spot on their show. You contact me today, though, at authorIanTotten@gmail.com. I'm going to give you the best price going in podcast advertising today. It's not going to cost you hundreds or thousands of dollars. In fact, we can get your ad on the air today for about the price of a tank of gas. And if you contact me today, I'm going to give you 2 weeks for the price of one. Again, that's authorIanTotten at gmail.com. Contact me today and take your business to the next level. Now, back to our case. Now, coupled with Justin Smart's story about possibly dreaming or having seen the murders taking place, other members of his family also came to law enforcement's attention, one of whom was his mother. Somewhere around the time of the murders, Marilyn Smart claims she found a bloody jacket in her basement that resembled Tina Sharp's jacket, and Marilyn said she had turned this into Plumas County Sheriff's Department. Now, the Sheriff's Department insists that it never received such a jacket. The person who really drew investigators' attention, however, was Marilyn's husband, Justin's stepfather, Martin Marty Smart. The interesting thing here, however, is Martin Smart seemed to go to great lengths to provide investigators with information on the case. And this started with his proclamation that a hammer had been stolen, because at that time it wasn't common knowledge that another hammer had been used in the murders. So the police started looking at Martin Smart and his friend John Beau Boudet pretty hard. In fact, they even interviewed both men and learned that they didn't know each other extremely well. Martin had met Boudet a few weeks before at a VA hospital where he was recovering from PTSD, as Martin was a Vietnam veteran. Beau ends up moving in with the Smart family after getting discharged. This was supposedly just until he could get onto his feet. One interesting thing about Beau, however, is that he made no bones about letting people know that he had connections to the mafia and was in fact a mafia hitman. Now, this has been neither proven nor disproven, but it is known that he was at the very least an associate of the Chicago outfit. Which, if this were the case, then Beau would have no qualms about committing murder. Nor possibly would Martin, as he is known to have seen combat in Vietnam. Now, Marty and Beau both had a ready-made alibi, which is that Marty had convinced Marilyn to drive the two of them down to the back door, which was the local bar. Along the way, they stopped at the Sharp household to ask Sue if she wanted to accompany them, and she declined this offer. Anyway, right, they went down to the bar, which Marty had worked at as a chef until a few weeks prior. The two men stayed at the bar drinking for some period of time before Marty began to become angry over the music that was being played, and they decided to leave and head back to the Smart household. And another bit of weirdness in an already strange case: Marty told police that he was so angry over the music that had been being played, he decided to call down to the bar and chew out the manager. And not long after this, he and Beau, now resplendent in leisure suits, headed back down to the bar. And people did actually see the two of them at the bar dressed like this, and those who came forward to police said that both Marty and Beau were acting oddly. Now, Marilyn stated in later years that she was awoken at some point after the men came back from the bar the second time to find them burning something in the fireplace in their cabin. And there's been some speculation that this was evidence from the crime. A number of people have also gone on the record stating that both Marty and Bo hated John Sharp. Remember, John was known as a bit of a troublemaker, a little bit of a partier. So that could possibly give some motive. But Marty also did his best to implicate both he and Bo in the murders. At one point during the investigation, when the Plumas County Sheriff's Office was talking with Marty, he had what many people see as a Freudian slip, where he said something to the effect of, "He," meaning Justin, "is so quiet that he could have seen me committing the murders and I wouldn't even have known he was standing there." That, coupled with the fact that Marty brought up the missing hammer, which police, again, had not released to the public, made him the number one suspect. There are also people who say that Marty and Sue were having an affair, and that Sue had either threatened to tell Marilyn about this affair, or in fact already had. And this is bolstered by the fact that the two of them, that be Marilyn and Marty, were having difficulties in their marriage, which were not specified beyond the fact that he was adulterous and abusive towards her. After giving these statements, someone from the Plumas County Sheriff's Department tipped off Marty that both he and Bo were suspects in the case. In fact, they were the number one suspects. And the two men fled the area pretty quickly, with Marty going to Nevada. And I've read two different versions, one that Bo went to Oregon, the other that he went back to Chicago. At this point, the case went cold and remained that way for a while. Sheila and her surviving brothers were sent to Oregon to live with family, and they were split up among different households. And from all that I have seen, they are doing well. All of them have grown up to be productive members of society. I have had a couple brief conversations with her a few years back when I was trying to get a YouTube project together, specifically focusing on this case. She seems to have grown into a strong, deeply spiritual woman, which isn't surprising given what she's had to endure, especially from the internet community of armchair detectives, some of whom have decided that she is in fact a suspect in this case, which I find highly unlikely. Now, the case might have gone cold, but it was far from over. And this is one of those parts of the story where I'd said at the beginning that it kind of ties into the area that I was living at in California. On April 22nd, 1984, which was just a little over 3 years after the murders, a bottle collector who was searching an area called Cabin 18, which is near Feather Falls in Butte County, discovered a cranium and a femur. Now, the way this ties into where I was living is that Butte County was the county just below where my family and I lived. We lived in a place called Tehama County. And this is the far northern portion of California. You're talking, you know, 3 or 4 hours north of San Francisco, and it is extremely desolate, rugged terrain. There's a lot of mountains and fields, and in the summer, rattlesnakes everywhere. And I'm sure some of you who follow true crime are curious as to why bottle collectors always seem to find bodies. The reason for this is in California, you can make money from turning in cans of bottles to recycling centers. where we lived, as well as down in the Bay Area, it's really common to see people walking on the side of the road or diving into dumpsters looking for them. So this bottle collector, he finds these bones in Butte County, out in the middle of nowhere. Butte County is only about 100 miles from Keddy. He contacts the Butte County Sheriff's Department, and they come out there. They found a blue nylon jacket, a blanket, a pair of Levi Strauss jeans with a missing back pocket, and an empty surgical tape dispenser that matched the type of tape that was used to bind the victims in the cabin. Shortly after the remains were found, an anonymous call came in claiming that the remains were those of Tina's, and actually, this call wasn't written down in any evidence log, but in 2013, a deputy who was working the cold case actually found a recording of it in the bottom of an evidence bag. At any rate, in June of 1984, the remains were positively identified as those of Tina Sharp. The case pretty much went quiet after that. There have been a few serial killers that have tentatively been linked to the case. Otis Toole and Henry Lucas, Robert Joseph Silveria Jr., but all of them have been discounted. Beau Baubede died in Chicago in 1988, while Marty Smart died of cancer. And again, here's the other connection to where I used to live in California. He died in 2000 in a place called Redding, California. You might see this on some websites such as Wikipedia stating that it was Portland, Oregon. Well, actually, it wasn't. It was in Redding, California. So that information is erroneous. Redding is probably the largest city in that area outside of Chico, but it's still fairly sparsely populated. It's a type of place where it'd be very easy to go to and disappear. In fact, a lot of people do go to that area and disappear. The Bay Area of California, which is, you know, San Jose, San Francisco, they are known to force people that are on their sex offender registry out of their counties up north, which has created a lot of friction between the Northern California and the Bay Area. The people that go up there, nobody knows them. They just kind of blend in with the scenery, so to speak. And it seems that's what Marty had done. He got one up there and just kind of lived quietly before dying. Now, on March 24th of 2016, a hammer matching the description of the hammer Marty claimed to have lost was discovered in a local pond up where the Keddy cabins had been, and it was taken into evidence by the Plumas County Special Investigator, who were headed by a man named Mike Gamberg, who stated that the location it was found, it would have been intentionally put there. It would not have been accidentally misplaced. He also said that there were potentially six other suspects that they were looking at. It was also learned during this time period that after the murders, Marty had fled the area, as I stated earlier, and he'd gone to Reno, Nevada, and he had sent a letter to Marilyn ruminating on the struggles within their marriage, and he concluded this with, "I've paid the price of your love, and now I've bought it with four people's lives." This is seen by a lot of people as him alluding to the murders that had taken place. And after Marty died in 2000, one of his counselors at a VA hospital came forward and said that Marty had, in fact, admitted to him that he had murdered Sue and her children, and that his friend Bo had participated in it, and he cited client patient confidentiality as the reason why he did not come forward. 2018, the Plumas County Sheriff's Department said that they had new DNA evidence that linked a living suspect to the crime scene, although from everything that I have seen, they have made no further headway that they have released to the public. So that's the Keddie murders. I mean, there's a lot more to this case than what I was able to fit into, you know, 45 minutes or so. A lot of it's really tedious, minute things. One of those things is the idea of why Sue was murdered. One of the theories that's out there, and this is the one that I actually subscribe to, is that Bo, who was looking to hook up with Sue, had gone to the cabin with Marty in order to entice her to come to the bar with him, as it was pretty well accepted around town that Sue was of somewhat loose morals. Remember, this is 1980, and women that were divorced were looked at much differently than they are in this day and age. Anyways, when Sue turned him down, he got upset with this, and when they went to the bar, you know, he's already angry. You mix that with alcohol, and it creates an explosive situation, so that by the time they left the bar, he'd already decided that he's getting laid that night, whether Sue wants to or not, which would also explain why she was found without any underwear on. Although I have seen no evidence anywhere stating that she had in fact had sex that evening, whether it was consensual or not. There's a couple different things floating around. One is that she had been wearing a bathrobe, another that she was wearing a t-shirt, or a tarp had been thrown over her. Everything I have seen, Sue is wearing a t-shirt, so I think the other stories of what she was wearing are just figments of that article's author's imagination. It's also been said that the sheriff of Plumas County at that time was in fact involved in drug dealing. I've seen a lot of things that state this. I have never seen any evidence of this. I believe that the current Plumas County Sheriff has, in fact, gone on the record and said that his predecessor was, in fact, involved in some shady dealings. So that could very well play into why Marty and Bo were allowed to leave. As I'd already stated, Marty was friends with the man, and it was known around town that Marty was a drug dealer, as was Bo. I think I'm going to leave the case here. If anybody is interested in discussing the case further, maybe throwing out some theories of your own, there is a Facebook group. Just search for Ian Totten Author and look in the tabs on that page. You'll see one for groups. There's a Deathcast group on there. I think right now we're about 155 members. I'd love to have you. I'd love to discuss the case further with anybody who's interested. That's going to do it for this week. Hope you've enjoyed the recounting of this tale. There really isn't any books that I could find on Keddie, so I'm going to throw one out of left field for a book of the week this week. And that's the book Deliverance by James Dickey. That's the book that the movie was based on. Dickey actually played the sheriff who's at the end of the movie. It is the absolute best book I have ever read, so if you have an opportunity to pick up a copy of it, give it a read. It's a lot more than two hillbillies raping a guy out in the middle of the woods. Till next week, stay safe and stay morbid. Thank you.
Welcome to the Deathcast.